Okay, so I'll be talking about combining electron microscopy with atomic models. And as we all know, electron microscopy can give us structural information on many complex systems, but is most often limited to non-atomic resolution, so usually in the 10 to 30 angstrom realm. And the techniques for getting atomic structures are usually limited by other requirements, such as crystallinity for X-ray crystallography or the size for NMR. So we'd like to take the best of both worlds and combine it into some information that encompasses both these sources of information. So we can actually gain atomic level information of these large complexes by docking atomic models into the lower resolution reconstructions. So but what we are actually trying to do in this case is to find the correct positions of highly localized atoms within a relatively low resolution kind of entity, which means we try to put atoms into blobs. So that raises questions such as, how can we do that properly? How can we prevent overfitting? We obviously can't just take a bunch of atoms and throw them into the density and have them refined freely. That won't get you anything useful, even though it's going to fit nicely. And how can we actually validate those type of fits? In other words, we need proper tools to do proper dockings. So there are several approaches to docking that were developed and used over the years. So the first one, obviously, was using manual docking, which has a couple of advantages, which is immediate visual feedback. You will be sitting in front of the screen and fiddling with your model, and you see immediately how that fits. It has, of course, heavy human intervention, and as such, a high level of subjectivity. It's prone to biasing and depends on the contour level that you choose for representing your maps. Another approach that was developed in Willy Rigger's lab is landmark-based docking, where reduced representation of the atomic structure as well as of the EM map are used. There's moderate human intervention in how these representations have to be generated. There's a loss of data through using the reduced representation rather than the whole data. And it's very hard to assess the error of docking positions because all the errors that are coming from the representation bit of the methodology is wrapped into the final misfit. So there's no real way to assess on how well the atomic structure actually fits the density in this case. A serious shortcoming actually is that it needs a one-to-one correspondence of the electron density map you're using and the model. So you can basically just fit a chunk that completely corresponds to what you have in the EM map. Then the next approach I'm going to talk about is density-based docking, where one doesn't need the one-to-one correspondence. You can fit bits and pieces of a larger molecule into a complete map. This can potentially handle modular docking, where you can take the model apart and just fit the single modules. There's very little human intervention. It explores the full density data. It's independent of contour level and unfortunately is relatively expensive in comparison with landmark-based methods. An approach that's related to that is based on the surface representation, where the data is filtered to enhance the surface layer and try to downweigh the internal features. So this also can potentially handle modular docking, but only if the modules have distinct surface features. It has relatively little dependency on internal features, which can be a good thing if you are working with negative stain maps, for example. It's generally not a good thing if you are using cryo maps, where you'd like to use the full information that's there. that relates to the next point, that the density data is not fully explored, and also the operation of enhancing the surface layer corresponds to a high-pass filter, which makes the method sensitive to high-frequency noise. And the speed is about the same as the standard density-based docking. Another approach, of course, is that's sort of like an add-on to the methods mentioned earlier, is local refinement or flexible docking, where you try to account for local variations. So if you have minor conformational changes that you can't model by modular docking, you can use this kind of approach to fix that up. So this can also incorporate quite naturally additional information like stereochemistry or normal modes, and I think that Florence Thalmer is going to talk about that in more detail in the next talk. What it does, however, is reducing the ratio of observables to parameters, so you have to be very careful that you don't run into overfitting problems where you have too many parameters for the amount of data that you actually have. So that's something one has to be aware of with those type of methods. This is just an illustration of what can happen. This is a test on lactoferrin, which has a fairly large conformational change. So the map was calculated from one conformation, and then the docking was done into the other conformation. And two approaches were used, one published originally by Regas and Berman in 2001, and one that we just published now. So the take-home message here is that with the modular docking, you get essentially the same type of fit that you would get with a least squares fitting of the atomic models after chopping them up into the modules. So the value for the best possible fit between the two models with these modules is 0.94 angstrom. So by using the modular approach, you get fairly close, and as you can see, the overall fit is excellent, obviously. So with the flexible docking implemented by the Regas group, you get a reasonable fit all over, but you have certain areas where you have fairly large deviations of the structures, which we attribute to using too many parameters in the docking problem. Okay, so there's one more thing you can do, which is the use of other types of filters. So one that's fairly popular is masking, where you take the density and mask out everything that's around it in order to enhance the signal, which is a good option if you have relatively noise-free maps. But again, it corresponds to a high-pass filter and can be problematic if you have lots of high-frequency noise. So another relatively new method is core weighting, where in addition to density evaluation, using some evaluation functions, there is also a weighting applied that's correlated to the shape of the density. So a disadvantage of this is that these filters usually slow down calculations sometimes very seriously. Okay, so to sum that up, all these approaches do either a comparison between atomic positions directly with density, or convert the atomic model to density and then compare, or convert the model and the density to something else and then compare. So this would be, for example, the surface-based docking or the landmark docking, that both are converted to something else and then compared. Then some of the masking procedures, like the one developed by Michael Rossmann, takes mask out everything but the atomic positions and compares that directly with the density. And most of the others do use this approach. So we'll focus from now on that approach. So once you've decided what you want to do in terms of docking strategy, you will have to decide what type of similarity measure you want to use. What will tell you whether the current fit matches the density or not. So according to a theorem out of the 30s by Neyman and Pearson, maximum likelihood gives the best possible unbiased estimate. There will be other estimates that might be better, but they won't be unbiased. So the reason why we want to be unbiased is because we usually don't know anything about the underlying structure, especially if the resolution is rather low. So many of the common similarity measures are actually some approximations of maximum likelihood, and one of those is the well-known correlation coefficient that's written down here. And this is a maximum likelihood measure if the noise is uniform Gaussian and A and E are independent, related by a, what's called an affine relationship, where E is equal to constant times A plus another constant. So the cross-correlation that's used through FFTs is not a maximum likelihood measure and requires an identity relationship between A and E. So this only works as something close to a maximum likelihood measure if both can be assumed to be identical. So it's not scaling invariant, the correlation coefficient is. So how good is the assumption that we have uniform Gaussian distribution? Well, for cryo data, it's pretty good. So this is from two data sets where we took just empty ice, which should have exactly the same value for each voxel, and we calculated a distribution of a large number of voxels, and as you can see, the data fits the Gaussian very well in both these cases and in other cases as well. So the assumption that we have uniform Gaussian distribution for the error is pretty good for ice data. For data that's coming from stained samples, the situation is slightly different. So this is from one of Brett Marsh's data sets, which is plastic embedded and heavily stained. And this is from Doris Hanin's lab negatively stained data set. And as you can see, the main difference is that there are differences in the tail of the distribution, which statistically makes a big difference. So the take-home message from this is that with these methods, you are much better off using cryo data than stained data. There are other reasons for that as well, which relate to the fact that cryo data is actually imaging the electron charge distribution of the underlying structure, and stained data doesn't do that. And that's very hard to model if it doesn't do that. If it does do that, then we can pretty accurately model the expected signal from atomic models. If we have like negatively stained data, that's not possible. Okay, speed considerations. So as I said, the correlation methods, density methods are not necessarily very fast, but there are several ways of speeding that up, one of it which is using fast Fourier transforms. Another way is trying to optimize the sampling in real space and calculate everything in real space. So this is taken, the FTM stands for fast translational matching, and FRM stands for fast rotational matching, and COAM is our program that we developed based on real space calculations. So these timings are taken from the paper noted here. And the difference between the fast fast translational matching and the fast rotational matching is that the fast Fourier theory was extended here to the angular realm. So this is only using the three translational parameters, and this is taking the three translational parameters and two of the angular parameters. But as you can see that the speed up you get through this fast Fourier treatment is comparable to what you get when you use pure real space calculations with an optimized sampling. So the reason why that's the case is if you do your calculations in Fourier space, you cannot restrict your search space as rigorously as you can do in real space. So in, what's that? It's, well, it's minutes, seconds, hours, minutes, seconds, minutes, seconds, minutes, seconds. It's, yeah, it's on the same processor. It's on a 1900 XP AMD processor. Sure. Yeah, it's matched. So the all the parameters are matched here. As a matter of fact, it's a disadvantage for the real space method because the sampling is dictated by the mathematics in the fast Fourier treatment of the angles, so you can only take a certain angular steps. So you cannot take an arbitrary step size, which you could do in the real space method. We matched the step size exactly to what was used here to get you know, a comparison in timing, but you could get away with much less for the real space because you could you know, use smaller angular increments without losing accuracy. I don't quite understand whether it scaled in what sense. If you use larger structures, well, I think the for the real space, it's definitely not linear. It depends on the shape of the structure and on various things, because what's done is try to find a sampling that's reasonable. You don't want to test, say, translational points that are irrelevant because they are outside the envelope. You don't want to test orientations that take more than half of the molecule out of the density and that sort of thing. So that's calculated as a function of the docking problem itself. Whereas these two things are much more ignorant to those kinds of considerations. Okay, so now we decided on what approach we want to take, and we did say what, or we did decide what similarity measure we want. So how do we proceed from here? Because we have to be aware we are dealing with data, right? So one way in the literature to sort of benchmark docking methods and say, okay, this works, this doesn't work, is trying to calculate densities and then, you know, apply the docking method and see whether it works or not. So this is an example that we did on myosin, where we took, where we generated an actomyosin map and a myosin map alone, and then tried to dock in the original atomic model that we actually use for calculating the map. So this is the resolution in Ångström for this, and this is the root mean square between the starting position that was used to calculate the map and the docking solution. So, and as you can see, for perfect data, which is the full range calculated, we essentially can dock in the atomic structure with an RMS from the original starting structure of about 1 angstrom at 100 angstrom. If we convolute that with random noise, we still can do that pretty well. It's better than 2 angstrom even at 100 angstroms. And even if we take an actomyosin map and just segment out the myosin itself and throw away the actin, we still get a very good fit. So does that mean we can actually rely on fits that we do at 100 angstroms with segmented data that has additional noise? I don't think so. And the reason for that is that if you put in a systematic error, in this case we used missing wedges for simulated tilt series, the picture is dramatically different. You get a reasonable fit at 25 angstrom, but then it breaks down pretty dramatically if you go further down. So now, what I'd like to say with this is one has to be very careful with evaluating docking methodologies with calculated data only, because it doesn't necessarily encompass what the real data looks like. Open question. Anyway, so if you take your average mathematical cookbook and you check up what genuinely useful docking procedure should provide, you'll find, obviously, as the first point, you want to find accurate and globally best parameters of the problem. But it doesn't stop there. You also like to have an error estimate, and you'd like to have some sort of a statistical measure that tells you whether this is actually significantly better than something else that you may find. So the authors of this particular cookbook go a little further than that and claim that many practitioners of parameter estimation never proceed beyond step one. So they say that it's acceptable if a graph of data and a model looks good. This approach is known as chi by i. So sadly, also in the docking community, most people concentrate on the first step, which is obviously very important. But we were trying to address the other 2 points by a methodology that we call solution sets. The idea behind that is that we define a confidence level at which solutions are still equivalent to the fit with the globally highest score that we find. And the meaning of that is that statistically all the solutions within the set do satisfy the data equally well and have equal probability in principle at that chosen confidence level to be the true or best solution. Right? So, why would that be important? So I generated this little hypothetical docking problem where you would like to dock this cigar into a noisy image of the cigar. And obviously, if you turn around this axis, you get a nice little graph for your similarity measure, whatever it is, and it's easy enough to pick the correct solution, which I put at zero angle here. However, if you twirl it around this angle and try to fit it in there, you will get something like this. So it's basically a straight line that's modulated by the noise, mostly dominated by that. So if you now go and pick the best global fit for this, you'll end up with this, which is almost as far away from the correct fit as you can get, which is again at zero. So what you really like to have is a method that tells you, well, look, you really have to consider all the solutions that are above this line. Okay? So, if you do this, you will find, okay, you have a certain width here that you should consider. And actually, if you are really careful, you also have to consider the solution that twirls this 180 degrees around. Oh, you're stuck. I mean, but this is already very important information if you are dealing with real data and a docking problem. It will tell you, look, your data is not good enough to lock in your atomic model, you have to do something about it. So what you can do, for example, is labeling. So if you put a label, you get a labeling function that is also dependent on the angle, and that will lock in this solution very easily and will also give you additional information on that angular distribution. So this is what we'd like to have. We'd like to have a method that tells us, okay, the data is not good enough to fix a single solution. The way we do that is using a tool, a statistical tool called Fisher's Lie Transform, which can be looked up in any self-respecting statistics book. And we first find the global maximum of the correlation coefficient and the standard deviation of the distribution. There are several ways of doing that. We usually do that by using a number of independent data sets. Then we choose a confidence level, usually 99.5 or 99.9%, which is sort of traditional in statistics circles. And then we just test each correlation coefficient for each fit and see whether it significantly differs from the maximum correlation coefficient that we found using the Lie transform. And if it's not significantly different, well, then it's part of the solution set. We can't really say that it's worse than the maximum we found. So this, the validity of the Z distribution, I should say, as a tool for getting confidence intervals is dependent, again, on the error distribution of the problem. And fortunately, it's also based on Gaussian shape. So it's in all likelihood, it's going to do a good job. So now, what does it do to some correlation distribution? So this would be another angular scan where we have a correlation coefficient on this axis, and it's along a long axis of some molecule, and you see that there's some variation, but it's very hard to tell which solutions to pick and which not to. So if we just pipe that through the Fisher's Lie transform, it looks like this. So we call this confidence plots. It's the square root of P on this side, and P relates to the confidence that you picked with this formula. Relatively straightforward. So now let's see that in action. So here we have the confidence plot. This line corresponds to 99.9% confidence. So if you would pick this, that would mean that all solutions that have values above the line are part of the solution set, and everything below the line doesn't. So you would have this little set here, which would be your solution set. So this is an NCD density where I put in the best fit we found. So what would that correspond to in terms of confidence? Well, it would mean you have basically zero confidence that this is the correct fit, because even if you move it a thousandth of an angstrom, it would be already different. Okay. So if you release the criteria a bit and you say, okay, good, so if I wiggle it a bit and consider another solution, then what that corresponds to is, okay, you lower this line, so you get higher confidence. And if you add more, that's going to continue until you end up where you want to be. So this would be the 99.9% confidence, and this would be the solution set. Okay? So each of these solutions, in principle, could be the best possible solution for this stocking problem. All of them are equivalent in that sense. So what we can do with this is to use the set to calculate parameters that we're interested in, such as coordinate error, can just be estimated as root mean square deviation of the positions within that set. And this is an example of an application of this. Here we did some modular docking of myosin into the myosin density, and the modules were the ND motor domain here and the light chains. So if you look at the root mean square deviation of the atoms, you can see a clear trend here that from the motor domain border to the outer rims, there's much increase in root mean square deviation. This is in two different directions. One is parallel to this and one is perpendicular. So you can even split it up in directional trends. Okay. Then another thing you can do is to calculate something we call interaction probabilities, where you just test the Hoole set for distant constraints with the binding partner. Then you say, okay, this particular residue is always in contact with the binding partner, this one only half the time, so the probability that that actually takes part in the interaction is lower than for the other one. And you can map it on to the atomic model that you fitted. So this is an example here, that's actin, this is binding domain of fimbrin, and this is the fimbrin molecule with the interaction probability mapped onto it. So blue obviously is very low probability and red is very high, and these are sort of in between, of course. Another thing, obviously, which is one of the reasons we started doing this, is that we can detect degeneracies, like for this problem. So this is another example, which is also taken from the fimbrin case, where the solution set actually splits up in two distinct groups that are 180 degrees away, so that would correspond to the flipping I showed earlier. So the way we can analyze that relatively quickly is by looking at a cluster analysis. So this is showing the root mean square between solutions in the solution set, and the length of the bar corresponds to the correlation value. And the cutoff for the solution sets is this gray level here. So in this case, we have, from the docking itself, we get four clusters. One is kicked out because it doesn't have anything that is making it part of the solution set, and then we have A, C, and D, which are still part of it. So if we look at that, how that relates to each other in space, we find that all the solutions can be mapped onto each other by these orthogonal axes. So it's all pseudo-symmetry at low resolution. So we can also compare that to the performance with the Laplacian filter, which is the filter that enhances the surface layer. And we can do the same sort of thing. We can do the Hoole analysis, but if we look at the final cluster solutions, this is the solutions for the plane density distribution, plane density correlation. This is for the Laplacian fitting. So this one, for example, is completely out of the density because the systematic errors that are present throw the solution off in this case. So this is the highest ranking cluster. This is also the highest ranking cluster for the Laplacian. They correspond to each other. The second highest ranking cluster for density correlation corresponds to the third ranking cluster and the Laplacian correlation. And these obviously don't correspond. So now if we use labeling in terms, in this case we use biochemical information as a label, we can do the same thing that we did with the cigar and lock into one of the solutions, and it turns out that this one is the correct one. So in this case, if we would have used and relied on the best fit, we would have been totally off. If we would have relied on the Laplacian density correlation, we wouldn't have found the correct solution. And this is basically it so far. I still have a little bit of time. I will go quickly through one application example where we used a helical reconstruction of actin-bound smooth muscle myosin with a four-step procedure. We isolate the myosin contribution from reconstruction, and how that's done properly, Dorit will talk about later today in the helical sessions. Then we define modules, and dock the largest module, subtract the contribution of the dock module, and then go back to step three. Okay, so this is the map of actomyosin, where actin is in the center and it's decorated with the smooth muscle myosin. We can subtract, do difference mapping with the actin that's not decorated, and are left with the myosin contribution only. Again, this is something that Dorit will explain later in more detail. Then we can isolate a single unit from that that relates to the original actin like this, and we can start trying to dock atomic structures into this. So this is the first conformation that was available at that time. Just fit. So this is done completely automatically. It's a completely automatic fit. Same for this one. This also doesn't fit. And the last conformation that was available doesn't fit either. But you can see already the fit is dominated by the large domain up front, the white thing. So now we know from the crystallographic analysis that myosin does segment into three different domains that move relatively independently. And you can actually find in an objective fashion where the correct breakpoints between the domains are if you have more than one conformation available. You can just compare the conformations and figure out where the correct breakpoints and pivot points are located. So this is what we did. And we started with docking the largest domain, which is the motor domain. We subtracted that from the complete map and docked in the next largest domain, which is this one here? Ah, good. Okay, so let's go slightly back. Okay, we fit the largest one first. That's then subtracted from the density. We fit the second one, subtracted from the density. We fit the last one, subtracted. And voila, we have a complete model that fits rather nicely. Okay, so, but... No, it's the problem is if you try to fit the smaller domain into the complete map, it will wander to the largest density mass. So you will have to start with the largest one, otherwise it's not going to work. So this is a quick remark about what we do and what I can just encourage everybody to do, because again, we don't. This is all very nicely and looks good and everything, but we don't really know whether it's true or not. So what we do is we do many, many dockings with independent maps and independent molecules or molecular models, which is nice with myosin because there are so many available, 20 plus by now, I think. And then we compile the statistics and look at that. And then once you have the statistics, you can do t-tests and you can see which one, which group of molecules fits best. So for example, here we can see that the complete motor domain in the prehydrolysis state fits significantly better than the one in the transition state because we have not only the mean of the fit, we also have a standard deviation, so we can do t-tests. And again, we can also use that this technique to estimate the accuracy of the fitting, which is written down here. And it's obviously different for each of the domains. Okay, so finally, we'll have atoms in size, and we can do the same thing all over with another conformation, and then we have everything in statistical terms. We can do t-tests between the movements, and we can figure out how it actually does the transition from one state to the other, which looks somewhat like this. So the states in between are just extrapolated, so it's only based on the data at the beginning and the end. A couple of nice things, you can see the rocking of the motor domain on the filament, which hasn't been seen before, and there's some twisting in the end of the lever arm here, which has been independently observed by fluorescence experiments. And this is where I'd like to end, just acknowledgements to the members of my group who contributed to this work, and to my colleague Dorit Hanin, who's going to give a talk later about some related issues. And I'd like to thank all of you for your attention and the organizers for inviting me. If you're lucky, you can just use it as an additional figure of merit, which is what we were able to do in the case of the light chain. We docked it in and then we checked whether the pivot point was wandering off. So the model, very simple modeling, just fixing the geometry with crystallographic programs. But it really doesn't make a difference in terms of correlation, because those local changes don't change much in the correlation values. It's just for mostly cosmetics. If it wanders off, you can impose it. You can say, okay, I don't, especially if you use near space methods, you can very naturally put in constraints, which is also a good thing if you have, say, a gold label of some residue. You can just say, okay, this residue is somewhere in the neighborhood of this gold label, and I don't want it to wander off more than X ohmstrom. And you can put that right into the program and it will do it for you. The same thing you can do with connection. You can enforce the connection. You can say, okay, I know it needs to be this particular residue where I have the chemical link between the domains needs to be somewhere there. We prefer not to do that because then we can use it as a criteria for the docking fidelity. Because if we don't stick it in and we get it back out without sticking it in, then that gives us an extra kind of idea that the docking did what it was supposed to do. If it turns it completely around, then we know, okay, the data is not good enough to fix this particular thing. But fortunately, we do know where it needs to be connected and we can stick it in. This experiment was done without any pre-segmentation. It was just taking the density and modular docking and the modules. I think what you are probably referring to is what I didn't talk about today, which is the fact that you can, if your resolution is good enough and the density characteristics of your maps are right, you can, in principle, pre-segment it. I was briefly referring to that when I was talking about the Meissen experiment with the calculated data. So that is an alternative if the modular docking doesn't work for reasons that Mark just mentioned, that two molecules are about the same size and roughly the same shape, so they don't know exactly where to go. Then you can pre-segment the density and use the segments as single entities you dock the models into.
Yeah, is it working? Yeah. Now I'm not going to speak about also trying to combine X-ray structure with cryo-electron microscopy EMA, but we are going to emphasize the fitting when we have large conformational change that are involved, and we want to try some methodology to be able to reproduce such conformational change. So why do we need flexible fitting? So there is a growing number of low resolution structures that are emerging from cryo-electron microscopy. And so we have that on one side. On the other side, we have some high resolution structure, but sometimes we don't have a match between the low resolution structure conformation and the conformation of the X-ray structure. So what we would like to do is be able to use the X-ray structure that is available and try to fit this X-ray structure in the conformation of the low resolution structure. So right now, as Nick explained, that you can try to divide your protein into several pieces and try to fit each of these pieces as a rigid body into the low resolution structure. However, in such when there is conformational change in proteins, most of the time you have correlated motion between the several parts of a protein. So we would like to be able to reproduce such motion, so going a step further than just dividing into pieces. And so what we want to do is try to use normal mode analysis. Normal mode analysis has been around for a long time and has been used to study dynamics of protein, of large structure, and in many cases we have found that we can get information of conformational change that proteins undergo using normal mode analysis. So what we want to try to do is have a program using this technology to be able to reproduce conformational change observed by cryo-electron microscopy. Just I'm going to go through the normal mode theory. So when we do normal mode theory, we represent our protein with a potential energy function. And in most of the case, the potential energy function is very complex function. But for normal mode analysis, what we are going to do is just represent this function as an harmonic potential. When we do so, we do so the harmonic approximation, but it helps us, in fact, by doing so, we can describe the dynamics of a biological system as a combination of some harmonic potentials that are independent. So when we do normal mode analysis, so here you have, for example, biological system, and here zoom view of a biological system. So when we do normal mode analysis, we get some motion ranging from some low frequency to high frequency. and so each motion are independent. When we look at the high frequency motion, in fact we see some motion that are like some bone stretching, angle stretching, so it's very localized motion. On the other end of the spectrum, we have a low frequency normal mode. So low frequency normal modes have very collective motion. As you see, we can see domain motion and such type of things. And in many cases, it has been observed that we can relate this large collective motion to conformational change that has been observed experimentally. So here is an example, for example, of a collective motion of the adenine actinase. This is the lowest frequency normal mode we get for this protein. And we have here each arrow represents the direction of the motion of each atom along this lowest frequency normal mode. And also the length of the arrow represents the amplitude of the displacement of the atom. So in this case, you see that most of the atoms are moving along this low frequency normal mode, and they have high amplitude. On the other hand, here is for the cytochrome C. If we look at high frequency normal mode, you can see the difference. In this case, only a few atoms are moving, as indicated by the arrow, and you see that the length of the arrow is very short, so that means it's very small displacement. So what we are going to do is try to concentrate on this lowest frequency normal mode that are collective motion. And here is, for example, what we can get from normal mode analysis. We can get conformational change of protein. So here we have in blue the open conformation of the adenine kinase, and in green is the closed conformation of the adenine kinase. These two structures have been observed by X-ray crystallography. And each arrow here represents the direction of a motion between the open and closed form for each of the atoms. Then we take this open conformation here in blue, and we do normal mode analysis on this conformation. So when we do normal mode analysis, we can look at each normal mode. Here we look at the lowest frequency normal mode since it's a collective motion. And here again, we are displaying the direction and the direction and amplitude of the motion of each atom along this lowest frequency normal mode. And we see that we have a good correspondence between the motion that is observed experimentally and the motion that we can obtain by using normal mode analysis. So here, the red structure is a structure that we obtain after normal mode analysis. And you see that it's really similar to the closed conformation of the adenine kinase. And so, in some cases, one normal mode can represent up to 80 or 90% of the overall conformational change. We can isolate the conformational change of biological system on one or two single normal modes. So what we'd like to do is that since such normal modes can predict conformational change of a biological system, we'd like to use the information that is given by the normal mode analysis to have a method that will enable us to fit the X-ray structure into a low resolution map using this theory. So here is just technique that we are using for normal mode analysis. So in fact, normal mode analysis has been around for a while, but because of a computational procedure, for a long while it has been limited to a very large system. Or when you want to deal with system that you obtain from cryo-electron microscopy is very large system. So recently, there has been this elastic network model that has been introduced, and this model has pushed the limits of a system that we can study using normal mode analysis. So here is, for example, how we represent the system. In fact, here is our protein, and we are just going to connect all the atoms of a protein by some spring. So if the atoms are within a certain cutoff distance, they will be connected by a spring, otherwise they are not connected. So here it's just a relation, so we have a distance of the atom, and it's just an UPM potential. And the potential total potential energy is given by the sum of this atom interaction. So using this technology, we can study very large systems, and so that's why now we can deal with cryo-electron microscopy. So now we can do normal mode analysis on very large systems, but we need to have a method that enables us also to describe the conformational transition between the two conformations of the same protein. So here, for example, we have a structure of elongation factor 2, so it's one X-ray structure, and there is also the X-ray structure of second conformation, and there is a large conformational difference between the two structures. What we would like to be able to do is to go from this direction, from this structure to this structure using normal mode direction. So we want to find a pathway that will bring from one conformation towards the next conformation. So we could do that starting from this structure and going directly to this one. But doing so using normal mode analysis, we could induce some distortion because this is a direct path, and most of the time when there is such conformational change, anharmonicity is important, so we need to consider non-linear approach. So to do so, we can use, rather than going directly from one conformation to another, we can use an iterative approach. So what we do is that we can take this structure, do normal mode analysis, and look for the mode that is describing the conformational change. Once we find this mode, we can move this structure even along the normal mode, so to get a new conformation that is a little bit different from this one. Once we have this conformation, we can again do normal mode analysis and find again the normal mode that is going to bring us towards the next conformation. So we do so like this, and we can repeat this iterative process until convergence towards this structure. So using such procedure, if we have a two X-ray structure, we can easily find a conformational pathway between the first structure and the second structure. So what we would like to be able to do now is that if we have one X-ray structure here, but here we don't have any more of the X-ray structure, but a low resolution cryo-EM map, we would like to be able to reproduce the same procedure. So we need to be able to select the normal mode that reproduces this transition. So it's here just summary of what we would like to be able to do. We know the conformation, one X-ray structure, and we know a low resolution structure, but we have a low correlation coefficient between the high resolution structure and the low resolution structure. So what we want to do is that take this structure, use normal mode to deform this structure toward a conformation that will have a high correlation coefficient with a low resolution EM map. So to do so, we need to be able to identify the normal mode that are going to represent a conformational change. So here we have a 2D map. We have, for example, direction along mode 1 and the direction along the second lowest frequency normal mode. And what we want to do, we are at this spot. And this is a map, contour map of a correlation coefficient. So we want to start from a low correlation coefficient and go towards this region of high correlation coefficient space. So, and we want to move the structure along mode 1 and mode 2. What we can do is try to use some minimization techniques like some steepest descent method. What we want to do is try to follow the direction, the steepest direction that will increase the correlation coefficient. So in fact, what we need to calculate is the derivative of the correlation coefficient in the normal mode space. And if we follow this direction at least, we will know that we can improve the correlation coefficient. So we can apply this equation to all the normal modes and look for the normal mode who have high gradient, high derivative of the correlation coefficient. Such modes will improve greatly, in fact, the correlation coefficient. At the same time, the sign of this derivative is going to tell us which direction I should follow along the lowest frequency normal mode. So this is in the case where the structure is far from a maximum of a correlation coefficient. once we improve the fluoridation coefficient to this point, we can use, so we are near a maximum, and in this case, rather than using a steepest distance method, we can use some Newton-Raphson approach. This approach are valid only when we are near a maximum, and using such approach, which needs the second derivative of a correlation coefficient compared to normal mode coordinate K and G, so mode 1 and mode 2 in this case, we can go directly from this point to the maximum of a correlation coefficient. So we try to implement this approach into a program. But first, to make sure that what we were doing is right, we needed to know if by calculating the gradient of a correlation coefficient, we were able to discriminate the normal mode that represents the conformational change from the normal mode that does not represent the conformational change. So here is an example where we know the two conformations of the same protein. So what we did is that we do normal mode analysis in one conformation, and we can compare each of the normal modes with a conformational difference between the two express structures here. So in fact, this is the overlap here. At the same time, we took this X-ray structure, we did normal mode analysis, and then we lower the resolution of this X-ray structure to 10 angstrom resolution. And what we did is that we calculate, in this case, the derivative of a correlation coefficient for each of the normal modes that we did on the X-ray structure. So here, when we have an overlap of 1, that means that the direction that is given by the normal mode and the direction of the conformational difference is the same. In this case, we see that we have normal mode of overlap 0.6. So that means this mode contributes a lot to the conformational change. And we see that when we have a high overlap mode, at the same time we have a high gradient mode. That means that by calculating the derivative of a correlation coefficient compared to each of the normal modes here, we can identify the normal mode that represents the best for conformational change. So that means that we can use such type of approach to try to do a refinement process of this X-ray structure into a low resolution structure conformation of this structure. So here is what we try to implement in what we call a normal mode flexible fitting program. So we try to use the natural motions that are given by normal mode analysis to do a refinement process of high resolution structure into low resolution structure. So our starting point is the X-ray structure and a low resolution EMR. So the first thing is we do normal mode analysis on our X-ray structure. Once we have each of the normal modes for the X-ray structure, we are going to do a gradient calculation. That means for each of the normal modes, we are going to try to calculate the derivative of a correlation coefficient to the normal mode coordinate. And then we rank the mode according to the value of the gradient. Then we are going to our steepest descent algorithm. We are going to pick up the modes that have the largest gradient, so that means the mode that improves the most the correlation coefficient. So once we pick up such normal mode, we can determine the amplitude that we should move the structure along the normal mode coordinate. So we move the structure along normal mode, we calculate the correlation coefficient between the new structure and the low resolution prior EMR. If we have an increase of the correlation coefficient, then we keep our structure and we start a new process. That means on this new structure, we are going to again do normal mode analysis, try to rank normal mode according to their gradient, and displace the structure. So we do that. At some point, however, we will have the correlation coefficient that's not going to increase. So if the correlation coefficient does not increase, we are going to reject the structure. And what we do in this case is that we just try to divide the amplitude we use to move along normal mode by a factor of 2. And we do again displacement and calculate correlation coefficient. If our correlation coefficient increases, that means that we are going to keep the structure, and then at this point, rather than to go back to steepest descent algorithm, we go to Newton-Raphson. Because at that point here, if we cannot increase the correlation coefficient here, and we have to divide the amplitude by 2, that means most likely we are near a maximum of a correlation coefficient. So in this case, rather than continuing a steepest descent algorithm, we are moving to Newton-Raphson algorithm. By doing Newton-Raphson, we can get the exact amplitude to use. And at that point also, if we divide the amplitude by 2, in some case, we may have a decrease of a correlation coefficient. So in this case, we are going to reject the structure, and at that point, we also start Newton-Raphson algorithm. Because if we cannot increase correlation coefficient, that means we are also near a maximum, or a maximum in this normal mode coordinate space. So once we do the Newton-Raphson, we have two cases. Why? Maybe we can increase correlation coefficient, maybe we can decrease. If we increase, we keep the structure. If we decrease, we reject the structure. And at that point, we are extending the number of normal modes that we are using in our refinement process. Because most likely, with this set of normal modes, we reach a maximum of a correlation coefficient. So in this case, even if we continue like this, we are not going to be able to improve more the correlation coefficient. So we try to move to 10 more modes, and we repeat this process. Usually, we stop with a number of modes that we are using for this flexible fitting method is 20. So in fact, in this procedure, there are not so many parameters. You just input the structure, your low resolution EM map, and mainly the parameter is the number of normal modes that you are going to use. Usually we are using only the 20 lowest frequency normal modes. That means we are limiting ourselves to the largest collective motion of the protein. So, and such normal modes are usually significant to represent conformational change. So just to see if this method is working, we took the X-ray structure of one protein, and we have also X-ray structure of the same protein and different conformation. And we lower the resolution of this conformation and try to fit this X-ray structure into this low resolution EM map. In this case, since it's only synthetic data simulated EM map, we try a perfect case where, in fact, the conformation of two proteins are superimposed by RMSC. So we pick up several proteins for which large conformational changes are known. So for each of these proteins, we have two X-ray structures that are available. So we have elongation factor 2 with a conformational difference between the true structure of 15 angstroms. We have the calcium ATPL, which is also a large protein, and there is a 14 angstrom conformational difference between the two conformations. And finally, we have also the lactoferrin, where we have 6.5 angstrom conformational difference. So what we do is that we take one structure, and for the second structure, we are generating a low resolution map. And we try to fit the X-ray structure into this low resolution EM map. So here is an example for elongation factor 2. So first, we see the first conformation of the X-ray structure, and we see the low resolution EM map of the second conformation. And here, we try to see, depending on the resolution, how our refinement process is successful in predicting the conformation of the second structure. So since we know the two X-ray structures originally, we can measure the success of our refinement by following either the correlation coefficient here or either the RMS between the starting structure and the final conformation. So we see that for each of our resolution, when we do our refinement process starting from low correlation coefficient, we can improve to high value the correlation coefficient. At the same time, we see that while we are improving the correlation coefficient, also we are decreasing the conformational difference between the initial X-ray structure and the refinement, the fitted structure. And here, finally, we have the low resolution map and the structure that we obtain after flexible fitting. So you see that we can get a much better fit of the structure into the low resolution EM map. So, and you see that in the case of this example is 10 angstrom resolution, the final structure differs by 2 angstrom of our targeted structure. So that means how we deform the structure is done in a reasonable way, since we are able to reduce the conformational difference between the two structures. So this was an ideal case because, in fact, we had the two structures with the same orientation. But when you deal with experimental data, you can have X-ray structures in one orientation and the low resolution EM map a different orientation. So we tested this possibility by randomly translating and rotating our original structure. With our methodology, we need to be able to have a good orientation between the starting structure and the low resolution EM map. So what we did is that we used some rigid body fitting programs that are existing to first take the structure, fit this structure as a rigid body into the low resolution EM map, and from this fitted rigid body structure, we use normal mode analysis to deform the structure to fit into the low resolution map. So here is what we get when we do that. So here I'm showing how we can decrease again ERMS. We see that in the case of elongation factor 2, we get similar results as the idealized case. We don't have any problem. In the case of the lactoferrin, however, we see that as before we could get an RMS of 1.5. Now, if we do the rigid body fitting before doing our refinement process, we have some problem. We see we can decrease the RMS, but then it's increasing again. So the structure that we get is not a good structure. So in this case, when we do the rigid body fitting, the orientation between the X-ray structure and the low resolution EM map is no more perfect. And so in this case, it's induced some error. And what we need to do in this case is try to, in fact, consider rotational and translational degree of freedom of the X-ray structure to try to adjust the orientation into the low resolution EM map. So what we did is that we added the rotational and translational degree of freedom that are provided by the normal mode analysis. So it's just this mode, our rotational and translational mode, as the protein is moved as a rigid body. And so we include such mode in our refinement process. So when we do that for the elongation factor 2, we see that we get some structure that is comparable with what we get before. So that means we are not inducing some error, but since there was nothing to correct, we converge towards the same answer. In the case of lactoferrin, we see that by adding the rotational and translational mode, now we can decrease the RMS to some value that were what we could obtain in the case of idealized orientation. So by adding such rotational and translational degree of freedom, we can adjust the orientation between the X-ray structure and the low resolution map, and we can that bring us to some structure that are in good agreement with experimental data. So here is an example of a flexible fitting of the elongation factor 2. So here you see, here we have the flexible fitting, so of elongation factor 2 at 10 angstrom resolution. So here we are showing how the correlation coefficient increased during the refinement process, and at the same time, how we can decrease the RMS between the two conformations. So here you see that at the beginning, we see some large conformational rearrangement of the elongation factor 2. So as indicated by some large decrease of the RMS, while towards the end of the refinement process, we have more localized motion and we have just some adjustment of some more localized motion, as because here we are using more higher frequency normal motion, more localized motion. And here we see if we do that with several types of resolution, we see that even at 30 angstrom resolution, we can converge to some structures that are within 3-4 angstrom of a targeted structure. So, as we use this elastic network normal mode analysis, and we see that we can get some structure in good agreement with experimental structure. But however, in our iteration process, depending on the number of iteration steps and the step size, we may have some problems. If a step size is too long, we may deform the structure too much, and that can lead to some distortion within the structure. However, if we use a too small step size, it can take longer, because we will need longer, a great number of iteration steps to converge to a structure. So when we use this elastic network model, it has been shown that we can use coarse grain model. That means, for example, it has been shown that if you take only the C-alpha atom of your protein, you can get conformational change of biological system. So what we try to do now is just see if by using only the C-alpha atom, we can get same agreement with during the fitting. So here is an example of C-alpha atom only for the flexible fitting for the calcium ACPS and elongation factor 2. So in this case, the simulated EM map is created using all atoms. But during the flexible fitting, we are considering only the C-alpha atom. You see that for the elongation factor 2, for any type of resolution, we can still decrease well the RMS between the original structure and the targeted structure. And here we have the original fitting of the calcium ACPS. You see that here there is an opening closing of this jaw. And after the flexible fitting, you see that we have much better fit. We have a closure of these two domains, and the final structure is within 5 angstrom of the targeted structure. So we are able to do flexible fitting using only coarse grain models such as C-alpha, so which is nice because we can deal with very large systems and we can get, it's less, computationally it's less expensive, and still it's working very well. So here is just a summary of what we could get using this normal mode flexible fitting and dealing with some synthetic data. So here is just a summary of all the structure we study with all atoms or just the alpha atom and the final RMS we could get towards the target structure. So you see that we can get some low RMS within less than 1 angstrom in some cases. And here is the original RMS. Now what we would like to be able to do is try to test this methodology on real experimental maps to see if it's working well. So we could have access to 3 cryo-electron microscopy maps. So first is an example of a single protein, the elongation factor G bound to the ribosome. that was given to us by Joachim Frank. Then we have example of multi-subunit protein complexes, the E. coli RNA polymerase, that was given to us by SEPTA. And finally, we also applied this methodology to some large macromolecular assemblies, such as the Copia chlorotic motor virus, where so it's a swollen form that was given to us by Jeff Johnson. So in this case, in the case 1 and 2, first we did a rigid body fitting, and once we did the rigid body fitting, we used our flexible fitting procedure with a 20 lowest frequency normal mode to fit into the experimental EMR. So here is the original structure of the elongation factor G. So it's the X-ray structure, and we have a cryo-EM map of the elongation factor G bound to the ribosome. So the resolution of this map is 10.8 angstrom. And in this plot, we are showing how the correlation coefficient is decreasing as a function of the iteration step, and at the same time, how the structure is deformed towards the compared to the initial structure. And so here, so you can see that we can increase the correlation coefficient nicely, and at the same time we see that after an increase of RNS, we are converging toward the structure, which is about 7 or 8 angstrom different from the original structure. So here is what we obtain from our flexible fitting. So you see at the beginning we have some large conformational difference, and toward the end we have some more localized motion. So here we have many motion of this domain 4 that is showing about 20 angstrom RMS difference between the original structure and the flexed structure. So we did calculation. Here is the example of all atom calculation. We did also the alpha atom calculation, and we converged towards the same structure. And the timing for this flexible fitting is reasonable, since it takes only 5 hours on a single processor to do this flexible fitting, and only 2.2 hours using C-alpha atom. Now we have an example of the E. coli RNA polymerase. So here we have the E. coli map, and we have a X-ray structure of the Thermus aquaticus that is available. So into the cryo-EM map, you see that there are some parts that correspond to E. coli insertion that are not present into the X-ray structure. So here we have the original rigid body fitted structure. And here is a flexible fitting. So you see that there is opening of this clamp here. And this is what we get after normal mode analysis. So we can also in getting here increase the correlation coefficient, and we convert toward the structure about 7 angstrom RMS compared to the original structure. So here what we should notice is that even if we have some E. coli insertion, we don't have any part of the X-ray structure that is pushed towards this E. coli insertion. It's because we are using normal mode analysis, and such motion are natural low-frequency motion the system can undergo. So even if there is some insertion there, we are not going to push the X-ray structure toward this insertion, because this is not a natural motion, and we are limiting ourselves to the natural motion. So this calculation takes a little bit longer, because it's a multi-protein complex, and so it's a larger system. But using C-alpha, we can get a structure that fits well the EM map into about 5 hours. And finally, we have an example for the for viruses. So the resolution is much lower, 28 angstrom resolution. So viruses have large macromolecular assembly, and so there is a lot of atoms. So in this case, it's easier to deal using only C alpha atom if we don't want to go through too long calculation. So here we have EM map at pH equals 5 of this virus, and the X-ray structure of the virus. When the pH is 7, the virus is swelling to a conformation with radii about 20 angstrom larger than the original X-ray conformation. So we perform our flexible fitting method, and you see that from a very low correlation coefficient here in red, we can converge to a high resolution structure. And here is in black the translation of the asymmetrical unit here in green, red, and blue. So we have an extension about 20 angstrom of the wall virus particle, and we see that bring also to large conformational rearrangement within the asymmetrical unit. And so using this flexible fitting technique, we could get this structure in 9 hours. So in this case, since icosahedral symmetry is always imposed in EM reconstruction, we also impose the icosahedral symmetry into our procedure. So that makes things going a little bit faster, and to do so, we choose also a specific orientation, because viruses can come in several orientations. We took the Viper foundation to have just one set of matrices to recreate the icosahedral particles. And just as summary, here's just the system that we study experimental EM map and with their resolution and how the correlation could be improved before from the original structure after the flexible fitting. And so what we want to emphasize is that we are using only the natural motion of a biological system. And so by doing so, we are deforming the structure in a natural way without inducing some distortion between domains, because they can be cut in separate places. So we are really taking into account the correlated motion between several parts of a protein. So that should lead to realistic conformational change. And just to thank the people that gave us EMA, SEPDA, Joachim Frank, and Doug Johnson. Thank you for your time. Exactly the same for any type of atom interaction, and we have seen that that's been shown that taking same Hopf constant, it's working well. And there has been some study to see if we take several Hopf constants depending on if it's the atom are connected by some bond angle or if it's more long range interaction, but it doesn't affect the lowest frequency normal mode, because such modes are mainly a property of the shape of the structure, and you are not going to affect such low frequency mode by changing the setting different force constants between certain type of atoms. So we just take the same force constant and